The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Grant Herod is a lecturer on early music in Yale's Department of Music and director of Yale's Collegium Musicum. He's also music director of the Yale Baroque Opera Project, whose 2014 production is Claudio Monteverdi's opera, The Coronation of Poppea. Grant Herod joins me in the studio to talk about the production. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, I think I'd like to start by asking you to give a brief overview of the plot of the opera.
Yes, it's different from other operas of the time and that preceded it in that it doesn't deal with mythology or, or legend even. It's sort of the, an historical opera involving, of course, the Emperor Nero and his Empress Ottavia. And Nero has fallen in love and fallen in desire more, maybe is a better way to put it, with a very aristocratic lady at the court, Poppea. And he's taken with her, and the whole opera circles around Poppea's sort of gold digger attempts to become empress herself and displace the Empress Ottavia, and various things that come in there between them. Chiefly, Nero's tutor and old teacher, Seneca, the philosopher Seneca, who is sort of the moral authority of the court. And so their first stumbling block is to get rid of Seneca, who is standing in the way of Nero's, intention to elevate Poppea. They get rid of him. Basically, Nero orders him to commit suicide, and then he's done with. Once he's out of the way, there's Ottone, who is Nero's chief general, who was in love with Poppea, and they were a couple, in fact. And Poppea has dumped him. And then there's the Empress Ottavia, who also tries not to be deposed herself. So between all this, basically, Ottavia enlists Ottone, the general, to kill Poppea, her rival. And Ottone, still in love with Poppea, just is beside himself. And he also loses his moral footing totally and tries to carry out the plot. He's discovered in the act of trying to stab Poppea to death, and he's caught. He's expelled, into exile, and Ottavia is sent away in exile. Seneca's dead. Nothing stands between them, and the happy couple is joined, and Poppea is elevated to empress.
So it's pretty bloody. It's pretty dramatic. It's pretty melodramatic.
It really is. It centers on all these relationships, Ottone and Poppea, the jilted lover, Ottone, who spends most of the opera complaining about his situation, which is actually pretty bad. He hooks up with another lady of the court, Drusilla, and with her help, he tries to carry out the plot to kill Poppea. So they have a relationship, very complicated. There's Poppea and Nero with very famous, very sensual scenes together in Poppea's bedroom and later at the court. There's Seneca's relationship with both Ottavia, the empress, and with Nero, his former student. And so it's just packed with drama, mm-hmm. Psychological drama, and as these relationships work themselves out.
Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out, it is probably one of the first, if not the first, sort of fact-based or history-based operas. How did that come about? Why did Monteverdi turn to something in history rather than sort of the more typical mythological plot?
I'm not really sure. It's interesting that in the whole sort of history of opera, the birth of opera, the idea of singing, an actor singing the story on stage was, very novel. at the beginning of the 17th century. And of course, the first operas dealt with the power of music itself in the person of Orfeo and also Apollo. And so it was sort of natural to feature music and sung characters singing their speeches when the power of music was the theme. Earlier than Popea, Monteverdi had turned to the story of Ulysses and his return after the Trojan War to his wife Penelope. So that was sort of a, you know, legendary step, sort of in between the mythological operas of Orfeo and then suddenly this, this, as you said, fact-based historical drama. The Venetians were very, very interested in the history of Rome and felt that they themselves were sort of the inheritors of the legacy of the Roman Empire. And so it was a topic that probably had some political implications too. I don't know if Monteverdi was sort of outspoken or, you know, was a secret Republican or something, but just to show the way that Nero and the emperors in general worked with their absolute power was very much of interest to the Venetian public.
Mm-hmm. Now, Yale Baroque Opera Project seems to have a real affinity for Monteverdi's music. This is, I think, the third of Monteverdi's operas in a pretty short history of this YBOP. So is there something to that? Is that intentional? Is it a coincidence?
It's both a... It's mainly intentional. Coincidence in that Monteverdi's operas are among the best that were written in the, you know, up through the period of the Venetian public opera. But the Yale Baroque Opera Project was in fact started by Ellen Rosand, the professor of music history at Yale. And she has written herself extensively on Monteverdi and his operas, as well as Venetian opera in general. And she basically wanted to do the whole trilogy of Monteverdi's operas. And so we started 6 years ago with Orfeo. 2 years ago, we continued with Ulysses, and now Popea. It's sort of the culmination of her dream for YBOP to... that's sort of her legacy, I think, mm-hmm. too, since she's really the noted authority on these operas in the world. It's very fitting that we should, and she's retiring this year, so we're getting it done for her so that she can go off with this legacy of having done all the Monteverdi operas.
So you are as the music director dealing with the real. Meat and potatoes of this opera. Are there any special challenges that you face in trying to support the pretty dramatic, melodramatic action on the stage?
Yes. The main challenge is that this program, the Yale Baroque Opera Project, was conceived by Ellen Rosand and funded by the Mellon Foundation and soon to be funded by the university itself. It's designed for undergraduates. And Yale, of course, has a very well-known and established graduate program in opera, in sort of straight-ahead opera. This Baroque opera, being designed for undergraduates, mean that we open the auditions for undergraduates, and they take it as a class. But the undergraduates are brilliant, you know, and very talented. And some of them are music majors, but most of them are not. And they have so many varied interests and commitments that the biggest challenge is to find time to rehearse the thing, you know. We have music coachings for several months, as I can sort of arrange with the students to meet with them personally. And then this time of year, we spend the last month and a half trying to schedule evening staging rehearsals, and it's very much a challenge to find, to get them all together, you know. Uh-huh. We'll do it, and we've always done it, but that is the main challenge, just working with the students in the context of their extremely busy academic lives, you know.
So what are they typically majoring in? Or is there anything typical? Is it sort of all over the map?
We've had pre-med students, mathematicians, lots of computer science types. You know, that's a very popular pursuit, I think, at Yale now, as everywhere. There are English majors, philosophy majors, and, as I said, some music majors.
I'm actually rather stunned by this. I'm really surprised to hear this. So what kind of forces are we talking about in terms of, you know, we think of a pit or whatever for an opera, more modern production or theater, but who do you have? What kind of forces do you have?
Well, there are, I guess, 12 or 13 cast members, singers. Again, all undergraduates except one recent grad of the opera program who was working at Yale, and we needed one role that she could sing, so we have her. The band is, again, keeping with the sort of authentic performance of Venetian opera in the mid-17th century. We are going to use two harpsichords, two theorbos, the large, long-necked lutes that were in these operas, a small string contingent of two violins, a cello, and a viola da gamba. I'm lucky enough this semester at Yale to, we have a couple of students from the School of Music, the graduate department, that are interested in playing early instruments. And I have a guitarist who's specializing now on theorbo and baroque guitar. And there's also a harpist that I procured a baroque triple harp for him, and he's learning that. So we will add to our ensemble these students, and we'll have two student harpsichordists for the first time. It's always been in the past a mixture of professionals and students, but the more this goes on, the more I'm trying to draw on just the student population. Mm-hmm. So it's very exciting. We'll have almost a student, Yale student ensemble with just a couple of professionals this time around.
Hmm. So how long is this opera?
The opera itself is around 3 hours, which is too long for us to do. So we've cut it down to about 2 hours and 10 minutes, mm-hmm. Plus the intermission. And that's, we found in the past that if it's any longer than that, it's just, you can't quite get it all rehearsed, you know, up to the standards that you want. So about 2 to 2 hours and 15 minutes is something that is doable. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of the story that's told.
Right. And I was going to say, you know, it sounds like it's so complex with so many different overlapping relationships and issues and things that it must be very difficult, though, to figure out which are expendable.
Yeah, a little bit. It's but in Monteverdi's operas in particular, they hadn't really developed yet the concept of or the practice of recitative sections and then, you know, separate arias. And so it's not a matter of this character has 6 arias to sing, we'll cut 2 of them, you know, and it doesn't really matter. Here you have to be a little more careful and really approach it more as theater and just see which lines you can cut, which characters maybe are a little more repetitive. And it's much more difficult. You sort of cut little things. We cut lines here and there rather than like whole arias. And we did actually cut one character. Ottavia, the Empress, has a nurse who has very little to sing, and it's very likely that her role was doubled by the original cast in Monteverdi's time. And it's perfectly expendable. So there were a couple of, that's the only role that we cut completely. But, that's not true. There was the god Mercury shows up, and the goddess Pallas Athena shows up for just, they each have 2 little segments. So we cut them as well.
So for someone who's more familiar with, you know, sort of the Metropolitan Opera experience, For someone coming to a Baroque opera production, how is it different? How and I mean even the nuts and bolts kind of stuff. How would you experience attending a production of Yale Baroque Opera Project that is different from the stereotype, if you will, of grand opera?
I guess the biggest difference right off the bat will be the size of the orchestra, of course, which is almost all continuo instrument-based. So again, the two harpsichords, two theorbos, do the bulk of the playing. And the violins, in the 2 hours and 10 minutes of the opera, the violins play about 20 minutes worth. So much of it is, and I think there's actually no time that singers are accompanied by the violins, which is very different from, you know, standard opera, of course. I might add the violins into a couple of sections. I'm not sure yet, but that's the biggest change, that even the arias are just accompanied by the harpsichords and the lutes, and maybe a cello on the bass line. So, and the strings only provide the ritornelli, the little introductions and playouts and things. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest change. Mm-hmm. We put ours on in the University Theater at Yale, a very standard, I think it holds about probably 700 or 800 people, including the balcony. So it seats, we usually get about 500 to 600 people to see these things. And so it's a very good size. It's not that different from the size of a Baroque hall from Monteverdi's time. But it's smaller than you would go see the Metropolitan Opera, say. And we don't serve champagne at intermission, unfortunately.
We have those undergraduates, too. You really can't.
Yeah, things are complicated on campuses that way. So that's another difference. And you don't have to wear a tuxedo. It's going to be, of course, fully staged and costumed. We spend a fair amount of money on the production values. So mm-hmm. it's the productions look spectacular. We have the full, you know, lighting. And there won't be any sound enhancement either, which, you know, you don't expect at operas these days, but you never know. I know that I used to play for the City Opera in New York City, and they had to amplify singers on stage just because the hall was so lousy acoustically. And I just was performing on Broadway with the Shakespeare on Broadway back in January. And that was one of the few Broadway shows that has no amplification as well from the stage. So this harks back to earlier practices in that it's, you know, totally acoustic, and so the orchestra being so small will be much softer. And that's another reason why these Baroque operas are really ideal for young singers. They don't have to sing over a whole orchestra. The vocal requirements often are, you know, just less strenuous. You need a less developed operatic technique to sing Monteverdi and Cavalli than you do for, you know, even Mozart or Donizetti and Rossini. So it's this earlier music is well suited to young voices and much softer. So it's maybe a more direct experience for the audience. Mm-hmm. They're not so far from the stage, and I think the whole experience is more intimate and more direct.
Mm-hmm. And because these are students and because so many of them are not music majors, as you surprised me telling me, I'm wondering how much education, if you will, or you know, real training in the kind of historical performance practices do you have to do? Or because they're not music majors, do you not even have to worry about it because they don't expect to be belting it out like Pavarotti?
No, that's very interesting. The reason that we have this Baroque opera project is that everything at Yale has to be, at least in the, you know, Yale College, has to be academically oriented. And so it's not just that we're putting on an opera, we are presenting a class, and everyone enrolled and performing in the opera is enrolled in the class. And they have to study historical theater techniques and also they have to write about their characters historically. There's a large academic component to it. And we study the way Monteverdi composed the music. So even though they're not music majors, we talk to them about music theory and harmony, and they have to analyze, they have to write their own recitative. It's a real immersion, like it should be at Yale, you know, as a Yale academic course. They have to write a few papers, mm-hmm. and as well as learn an opera and commit to evening staging rehearsals and mid, you know, during the day music coachings. It's quite a time commitment.
So you mentioned that Ellen Rosand is retiring, but the Yale Baroque Opera Project will continue.
It will continue, yes.
Do you have any inkling that you can share about what might expect for next year?
Ellen's conception of the program would be to do Venetian opera from the 17th century. And so far, we've done that, except for the very first Orfeo, which Monteverdi's Orfeo happened while he was still at Mantua. So we have, in between the Monteverdi operas, we've done two or three by Cavalli and one by Socrati. So all from the same time period. And some people in the music department would like us to expand, you know, and do maybe some French opera or even, you know, something like some of the operas from Rome, say, from the 17th century. So we might expand like that. I have some ideas that I've talked with Ellen Rosand about presenting even sort of our own pastiches, which Ellen and her sort of core founder, Richard Lally, put together, these sort of pastiches of bits of opera scenes and things. So we might experiment with that as well. But Professor Rosand is involved as the general editor of a new series of publishing all of the Cavalli operas. And so every year there's a new opera with a brand new edition that she would love to hear on stage, you know. So that will still, I think, probably be part of our mission too, to present the works of Cavalli and his contemporaries from the Venetian, you know, the heyday of the public operas in Venice. We'll keep doing that, but we're looking for ways to expand the experience for, you know, because each year we really don't know who we're going to have on the campus, you know. So we have to be flexible enough to, we're really there to serve the students. Mm-hmm. So if we have some students that will really excel in a certain kind of work or a certain role, then that's really going to influence what we do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I look forward to hearing what is next for you, and thank you very much for making time to speak with me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Suzanne.